The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of September 18th, 2017. On this week's show, Gene Demby of NPR's Code Switch podcast will be here for a conversation about Jemele Hill, Clay Travis, Donald Trump, whether it's okay to call the president a white supremacist, and how ESPN is handling attacks from conservative trolls. Eric Raskin of HBO Boxing will also join us to discuss the fantastic fight between Gennady Golovkin and Canelo Alvarez, which ended in a draw thanks to one awful scorecard, which leads one to wonder if boxing will ever be able to get out of its own way. And finally, we'll talk to one of the top contenders on the obstacle course reality competition, American Ninja Warrior, an amazing athlete who happens to share a name with one of your favorite podcast hosts. Yes, on today's show, Josh Levine and Stefan Fatsis will talk to Josh Levin. Joining me in Washington, D.C. is Stefan Fatsis, the author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic. Hello, Stefan.
Hey, Josh.
And no Stefan Fatsis, no great athletes with that name.
Maybe someday. Maybe there's a little Stefanos Fatsis up in Thessaloniki training hard right now for the 2028 or 2032 Olympics.
If you're out there, let us know. We'd love to have you on.
Last week on Twitter, ESPN Sports Center host Jemele Hill called Donald Trump a white supremacist who has largely surrounded himself with other white supremacists, an unfit, bigoted, incompetent moron, and the most ignorant, offensive president of my lifetime. A lot of people had a lot to say about this, including Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Let's listen to the spokeswoman for the President of the United States weigh in on the employment status of an individual at a private company.
I think that's one of the more outrageous comments that anyone could make, and certainly something that I think is a fireable offense by ESPN.
The president himself tweeted about ESPN's programming schedule and business fortunes. Idiot provocateurs like Clay Travis were given a new platform for their phony sports culture war. And as Josh wrote in a piece on Slate on Friday, ESPN made matters worse by throwing Hill under the bus. Gene Demby is a correspondent with NPR's Code Switch, a blog and podcast about race and identity. He is here in the studio with us. Hey, Gene.
What's good, guys?
Well, ESPN in its statements and also in a column by its public editor have framed this as a journalist making political comments in violation of company policy. But there is, shall we say, a large body of evidence backing up Jemele Hill's conclusions. Where do you begin to unpack this? Journalism race? Jemele Hill's race? Gender?
I mean, doesn't it seem like to you guys that this conversation is a lot of ways about the way that like the tenets of journalism often like obviate conversations about things that are true, that may be true, right? Like this conversation is about neutrality and it's about objectivity. That's what it's become about, right? I've been called into the principal's office for tweeting recklessly before, so I'm trying to like tread lightly here. One, like there are the ways in which all of us at media organizations have sort of like social media guidelines that we have to adhere to. The other part of it is like, white supremacist as a term is one of those terms that like that
alarm bells.
Yeah, I mean, and I think people have this fundamentally don't understand what someone like Jemele Hill was saying when she said something like that. Right? She's not calling him a Klan member. She's not saying he's the president of the United States is using the 14 words. When people use the term white supremacy, they're talking about the basic premise that whiteness should be central to American life and culture and politics. Right? And like, that has been the operating – that's like part of the source code of the United States, right? That's been the operating premise of the United States for all of its history. And so
– this is like the idea that it's worse to be called a racist than actually to be a racist.
Right, exactly.
That it just makes people insane when that accusation is made.
It's like calling somebody a child molester, right? It's like this – like the it's like an you're impugning their character.
Right, and then layering on top of that are these traditional norms that – that established American media companies have operated by. I mean, when I worked at the Wall Street Journal, you couldn't do anything, right? I mean, the rules were so clear cut about opinion in a public space, pre-Twitter,
right?
Political activity, donating to any organizations. I mean, the rules were cut and dried.
Right.
Going on radio shows and having any opinion at all. Those rules have obviously changed because of A, the social media context in which we live now, but also as you pointed out, Gene, the people that are being empowered to have opinions. I don't know that Jemele Hill is a journalist in the way that I was a journalist covering an industry for a major newspaper. Mm-hmm. So
she's always been a columnist and, she was elevated at ESPN because of her opinions and because they're provocative and interesting. But before we get into her specifically, like Maggie Haberman, like think about her. She is like maybe at the top spot at the top newspaper in the country. And she
covering the president.
And she tweets things that you could never get away with tweeting at the New York Times maybe 5 years ago.
5 years ago, yeah.
Or even 10 years ago. And then, you know, Jemele Hill, she's basically the top spot at ESPN right now, hosting the 6 p.m. Sports Center, which has traditionally been the showcase show of ESPN, like the quintessence of what ESPN is and does. And they've totally changed what that show is to fit her and her co-host Michael Smith, but yet there's this tension, right, between, you know, ESPN wants her there because she's distinctive, because she's provocative, because she has this personality.
And because she's African-American, let's be clear. That show came out of a podcast and a collaboration between these two young, smart, interesting, thoughtful African-American sports journalists.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right. And so then what you end up having is a sort of institutional, this institutional incapacity to deal with what that means, right? Yeah. I think there's this idea that having diversity just means putting some brown people in the room, putting some black and brown people in a room, but it also means you have to rethink a bunch of ideas around, you know, neutrality and objectivity. I mean, without making any sort of judgment on whether or not she was right or not, like the idea that sports fandom is separate from racial politics is like not a way that many of my friends of color who are sports fans understand their fandom, right? I mean, like, you know, I was talking to one of my colleagues who is from D.C. but is not a fan of the Washington football concern, the Washington NFL, Washington football concern. It's like because the NFL, that team was the last team to integrate, right? And so for black folks of a certain age in the city, like that team is a sign of like revanchism, of like an aversion to integration, right? Like I know I inherited my mom's deep hatred of Boston sports and the Celtics because of all these ideas she has about Boston and Boston racism, right? And so like the idea that, I mean, and Jemele Hill actually got popped for saying something about Boston sports along these lines a few years ago. And I think there's a way in which that racial politics informs sports, not just for people of color, but for everyone in a way that like it would be, that it is often, because our newsrooms have been dominated by white guys for so long, it often looks like it's neutral when you don't explicate that, right? And when you don't explicate issues of race, which again is like a slightly different issue than whether or not Jemele Hill should have said something on Twitter. But like it is also like when you invite someone like Jemele Hill into the room, you are assuming that they are going to talk about issues of race, right? And those issues of race are like wrapped up in our partisan politics.
The thing that's bugged me about this whole thing from both sides is that there's just a disingenuousness. The only person who's not being disingenuous here is Jemele Hill. She's saying what she believes, and she's doing it in a way that I don't care what the guidelines are. She's doing it in a way that her employer has sanctioned by the fact that they've, you know, put her on, you know, the 6 p.m. Sports Center. She's a star at ESPN. They want her to be doing what she's been doing. But in their response to it, what ESPN has said is, you know, there might have been some confusion about whether she was speaking, you know, on behalf of the company on this platform. It's like from her personal Twitter account. No serious-minded people are going to think that she was tweeting, you know, what John Skipper, the president of ESPN, wanted her to say. She wasn't ventriloquizing anyone. She was just saying what she believed. And then on the other side, you have folks like Clay Travis, like the president of the United States, who are just saying things. I mean, the president is really dumb. Maybe he just doesn't understand what's going on in like cable with, you know, bundling and cord cutting and everything. But I think Clay Travis is working a hustle. He knows that, you know, subscribership isn't going down at ESPN because of politics, because people are just so upset about Caitlyn Jenner getting an ESPY or Michael Sam kissing his boyfriend.
Or Kurt Schilling getting fired.
Everyone who's looked at data, everyone who's thought about this knows that, you know, subscriberships are going down across cable, and people don't subscribe to ESPN separately. It's not, we don't have like an a la carte cable system. Like subscriptions to like TNT and the Cartoon Network are going down too. And so just the insincerity, like if someone wanted to argue that ESPN being more political had like alienated a certain segment of the audience and wanted to have like an intellectually honest conversation about that, I think it could be interesting. But that's not the conversation that we're having.
And also the numbers don't really back that up, right? I mean, the numbers about like whether people feel like ESPN is too ideological is really like the data doesn't really bear that out, right? And a bunch of people think that ESPN should be something like 8% of the people think ESPN should be more political. The big chunk of people in ESPN's own survey, I think the plurality said that they were like ESPN was exactly where they wanted it to be.
It's similar to the phony polls or the misinterpreted polls that say that people were turning off the NFL last year because of exactly. Colin Kaepernick.
Mm-hmm.
The data does not, upon closer scrutiny, back it up.
Mm-hmm. But so why do you think this narrative exists then? I mean, like, why do you think it has so much traction, this idea that like ESPN is this crazy lefty outfit, which of course it isn't. It's like an outfit that is like incredibly credulous of it, the big institutions, right? I mean, it's incredibly credulous of the NFL and the NBA and the people who like make money for it.
But I would also say at the same time, ESPN has proven in its journalism to be a pretty smart and progressive institution on matters of race and gender and politics. I mean, from magazine stories to TV shows like Outside the Lines and E60 to its 30 for 30 content, the documentaries like the recent one about the Dallas Carter football team. I mean, these are often very nuanced, very smart, very thoughtful takes on the intersection of sports and race and class in America. They're good at that.
I just think it's overdue. I just think it's overdue. Like, I think that the culture war and the allegation that the media is excessively liberal has been going on for decades. And the surprising thing is it took so long for folks like Clay Travis or, you know, whoever else to latch onto this idea that sports could get wrapped up into it. And, you know, as you were talking about earlier, Gene, this notion that it's somehow neutral to avoid talking about politics and to just do the scores and the highlights is a pretty absurd and ridiculous and privileged, idea to have in this day and age or any day and age, really. But it's one that I think that sports media, particularly on television, has allowed people to have, announcers have, talk openly about how annoyed they feel when they have to talk about, I have to talk about Ray Rice during the game. I guess I have to make the perfunctory, one paragraph statement about what he did. And now let's get back to football. So I think, I don't know whether it was intentionally or unintentionally, but I feel like ESPN has kind of encouraged, and all of sports media have encouraged people to have this idea that politics is an intrusion. And so I think there was actually a receptive audience of like right wingers out there who, when this was brought to their attention that ESPN's like really doing this bad thing, aren't they? Like, yeah, I guess they are.
It's also like telling that, Jemele Hill and Michael Smith had become sort of the locus, the site of all this anger and animus. There was that great Ringer story by Brian Curtis about Jemele Hill and ESPN, which you guys should check out if you haven't read it, about how, there was an article that had been done on ESPN's drop in ratings. And the culture, sort of the internal political culture of ESPN. And there were thousands and thousands of responses to that article. And half of them were about Michael Smith and Jemele Hill, even though they were not in the article at all, right? And so, and that's what kicked off Ryan Curtis's reporting, like what it is about Jemele Hill and Michael Smith that gets under people's skin. And I think, it's hard to come to some other conclusion that it's like two youngish black people on TV talking about the way that sports fandom is not partitioned off from the wider world.
Well, and their blackness is a part of the show. It's
absolutely.
Not like incidental
absolutely.
To it. It's unapologetic, and that's what makes their show distinctive. And I think it's to ESPN's credit that they gave them the show. And ESPN, it should be said, has been like amazing on representation compared to the rest of the media, compared to like Slate and NPR, I think. You know, there are so many talented people of color that have been on ESPN over the years. And I think one of the reasons that they're bearing the brunt of this criticism is because of, the decisions they've made in hiring.
Absolutely. I mean, it's always worth remembering that like the mere presence of a black person in a room saying something is charged in a way that it is not for a white person, right? Jemele Hill seems to irradiate conversations just because she's in them, right? And there's not really a lot of precedent for someone like her. There are black women on ESPN who are like anchors and moderators of the panel shows or whatever, but they don't do exactly what Jemele Hill does, which is like to synthesize and contextualize and like be sort of supposed to be like a fan's proxy voice in a lot of ways, right? And I think that is really upsetting to people. Like, and I think that's like upsetting to people in spaces that are not sports, right? There's a thing that like American society broadly is grappling with. Like, it's interesting to think about the ways that ESPN is trying to figure out, you know, how to navigate this moment mm-hmm. as like, you know, so many other institutions in sports are doing the same things. Like baseball has this perpetual sort of navel gazing about like what to do about the overwhelming whiteness of its TV audience, right? Like that's a existential problem, right? In 30 or 40 years, like, I mean, if the median age of baseball fans is like in the 50s and it's 85% white, the audience is 85% white, which by the way is like the general demographics of NPR listenership. Like that is an existential problem for this institution, right? And ESPN, like the country is not going to look like that in 30 or 40 years, right? Like ESPN is dealing with what it means to be on the front of this, on the front lines of like this demographic shift that we're seeing.
Right. And institutions don't do a great job of pivoting and adapting to the times. I mean, ESPN's public editor is a middle-aged white guy.
Right.
And he wrote a column effectively excoriating Jemele Hill, not for having an opinion, not for expressing her opinion, but for violating the narrow box of what ESPN has written down in its policies about what is appropriate for an ESPN employee to say in public. I mean, you could argue that, well, maybe the policy is wrong and it's not the employee that's wrong. And maybe ESPN is lacking, as you point out, Gene, a sort of better nuanced understanding of what it means for a person of color, a young person of color, to use the term white supremacist, even when describing the president of the United States.
Right.
So someone needs to change here. And I think that a lot of people would argue that it's not Jemele Hill.
Right, right.
Well, ESPN is a big and messy and complicated place. And as I was saying before, they should be lauded for putting her in this position in which she's become a lightning rod, I guess. But, you know, Deadspin got internal message board postings from ESPN. And, you know, in many ways, it's the same conversation that's playing out elsewhere on the internet. There are some of her coworkers who are not very happy with, you know, what she did and are playing the same false equivalency game of like, she did the exact same thing as Curt Schilling, who, by the way, was like, calling entire racial and religious groups of people like subhuman basically on a consistent level for years. And there are people, you know, again, who I think are disingenuously saying he did the exact same thing as Jemele Hill and he got fired. So like, you know, what's he has been doing? Like people within the company are having these same exact conversations that are going on outside it.
And I think it's important to note that, like we said earlier, it's not surprising that a company like ESPN would have a policy like this and seek to enforce it in order to alienate as few people as possible.
Right. There's a lot of ass covering going on in these statements. And the one thing that ESPN didn't say in the statement, like to its great discredit, was we stand behind Jemele Hill. And, you know, she said this thing that she said, we don't necessarily agree with it. It obviously isn't a corporate statement coming from her personal Twitter account, but we stand behind her right to say what she wants to say. Like, that's, I think, what the correct statement was, but maybe there was a calculus that would just alienate too many people.
And as someone pointed out yesterday, the fact that the White House weighed in basically ensured that Jemele Hill would not be fired, right? Because then firing her or reprimanding her publicly becomes a political conversation.
Well, that was the amazing thing. Like, this is the part I actually don't understand, because even though I don't agree with it, I can understand why ESPN didn't come out on its, like, official, you know, PR account to say we stand behind Jemele Hill originally. But after Sarah Huckabee Sanders said what she said and after Trump said what she said, the fact that they didn't come out and say we're not going to be intimidated and we're not going to, you know, do anyone's bidding, whether it's the White House or anyone, around, you know, what employment decisions, and we stand behind her. The fact that they didn't say that did actually surprise me.
Yeah, the thing that's so scary about this, right, I mean, and again, whether or not you think Jemele Hill was right or not, like, is the way that because because white supremacy is the thing that looks neutral and it gets wrapped up in our partisan politics, that pointing to it will become increasingly difficult because it will always – you will end up indicting what people say is like half of the country, right? If you say the president is somehow in proximity to white supremacy, right, what you are doing is this like journalistic sin, right, which is not calling out white supremacy, but to like to actively involve yourself in like partisan electoral.
Well, you are making a choice to use a loaded phrase that is going to incite certain people. Jemele Hill probably could have tweeted, "I am deeply disturbed by X, Y, Z." And
exactly.
She did in her Twitter feed enumerate the things that the president has done that have upset her, none of which are shocking, none of which anyone would dispute. These are facts. And she was criticized by the public editor for not using facts to support an argument. She's not a journalist. She's not covering the presidency. She's a citizen in this regard. And yeah, whatever she says is going to reflect back on ESPN. And yeah, ESPN as her employer does have the ability to say, we feel that that's inappropriate. Whether they need to go public with it is another matter.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things that like, I've been talking to my friends and I have been having a million conversations about the Jemele Hill situation. And I don't know what to make of it in a lot of ways because, again, like as journalists, you know, like if you work at The New York Times, you work at NPR, you work at any number of places, yeah. You are constrained by these rules of conduct. I mean, there are people at The Washington Post who don't vote, right? There's like a bridge too far, right?
Yeah.
Which is insane.
I had an editor at the Journal who didn't vote.
Yeah. That is sort of an insane position. It's like you've checked out that is an insane position to take to me, right? And also, like,
that's just performative neutrality. That's just pointless performative neutrality.
It is. But also, like, neutrality is wrapped up in these ideas of whiteness, right? Like, and like that you don't have any, like, all of us, black folks, white folks, Latino folks, come to this stuff with like stakes, right? Like, with like baggage and stakes. And like, I don't understand the journalism that I do as anything other than a black man, right? Like I've always been a black man. I understand police shooting stories as a story, like with a specific lens. And I think there's a way in which the overwhelming whiteness and maleness of journalism for, you know, the conventional whiteness and maleness of journalism has made it seem as if that is a neutral, objective position to take. And so all these rules, these sort of rules of the road and standards of conduct are informed by this like idea that you can be like separate and distinct from issues of race and gender, right? And of course they aren't, right? Of course you can't be. And so I think there's like this fiction that we all live inside of and we're all trying to wrestle with. Like, and it looks really ugly because it's happening in public, right? We're all sort of trying to figure out what the rules of the road should be going forward. Should it be transparency rather than neutrality? Should it be fairness instead of objectivity? Like, those are not the same things. And I think we're trying to figure that out loud. And I think Jemele Hill's like right in the crosshairs.
My last thought on this, just I had one additional thing I wanted to say about why ESPN and why now. I think ESPN is really one of the last vestiges of mass culture that we have. And so when, you know, Obama became close to Jemele Hill, and for him, she was this like important towering media figure. She's like, on the one hand, she like wasn't the subject of like national conversation and debate before this past week. But she's like, given that ESPN is like as prominent as it is and given the position that she has, she is like an important big figure in the media. And so it's actually not ridiculous that the president or the president's spokesperson would talk about ESPN. It's ridiculous what they actually said about it. But I was like reminded of this when Charlie Pierce, who I love, and Sports Illustrated, an institution that I like revere and love, wrote in an SI in defense of Jemele Hill. And he said at the end, "The president of the United States is a white supremacist and a racist, just like his odious father was before him. Go ahead, Sarah." Speaking of Sarah Huckabee Sanders, "tell them to fire me." Charlie Pierce, great writer, Sports Illustrated, great institution. Nobody said anything after Charlie wrote that because SI in this moment of history just, I mean, forgive me, but nobody really cares what Charlie Pierce says in an online column in Sports Illustrated.
Well, Charlie Pierce is a 60-something-year-old white journalist writing for an institution that is not as hip or prominent as ESPN and certainly not as hip or prominent as Jamel Hill is
right,
right now,
right,
Gene?
That's absolutely right. I mean, it matters that Charlie Pierce is a white guy, right? It matters that he's saying these things. And I think this is, like, what we're wrestling over. Like, who gets to say what and when? I mean, Clay Travis is... Whatever, I'm not going to, I mean, but there are ways in which, like,
we can all fill in the blank after Clay Travis is.
But there are ways in which growing up as a sports fan, in which, like, I was cognizant of all the ways, like, all the very subtle ways in which I was reading columns in the Philadelphia Inquirer that were like, this is racist as hell. Like, you know what I mean? And, like, no one who was editing that column understood it that way, right? And I was, like, receiving it that way. And I'm sure, and I was a kid, right? And so, like, there's all these people of color who are consuming this stuff, who are consuming sports media for decades, and having to, like, swim and navigate through the default whiteness of all the opinion makers and all the people who get to be, like, the synthesizers of the big ideas. Jemele Hill is part of this, like, this weird disruption of that space. And I think, like, these anxieties are not going to go away anytime soon. I have no idea how they resolve themselves. But, like, this is what correction looks like. It looks ugly and it looks sloppy. But, like, the whiteness of that space before was artificial and not and constructed deliberately. And it was never a neutral thing. And so what Jemele Hill is doing now doesn't seem neutral, but it was never neutral. It never has been.
Gene Demby is a correspondent with NPR's Code Switch. Gene, thanks a lot for coming on.
Appreciate y'all. Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Before we get to the Triple G Ganello fight, heads up that in our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, we're going to talk about whether the NFL is really bad and boring now, or if it just feels that way. If you want to hear that conversation, please join Slate Plus. It's $35 a year. It's $5 a month. $35 a year is a better deal because of math. If you do join, you can get a Slate Plus tote bag. You can get bonus segments on this and other Slate podcasts every week. Sign up at slate.com/hangupplus. On Saturday night in Las Vegas, a pair of boxers fought in a professional boxing match, and it turned out to be a good match of boxing. Go figure. Canelo Alvarez, a 27-year-old from Mexico, who came in with a record of 49-1-1, with that one loss coming against Floyd Mayweather 4 years ago, took on Gennady Gennadievich Golovkin, known as Triple G, a 35-year-old from Kazakhstan who had a record of 37-0 with 33 knockouts. Before the match and after, Golovkin talked about wanting to give boxing fans a, quote, drama show, and the middleweights obliged, trading and evading big punches for 12 rounds in what was by acclamation a competitive and evenly matched fight that Triple G probably won. The three judges scored it 115-113 for Golovkin, 114-114, a draw, and somehow 118-110 in favor of Alvarez. With one scorecard for each fighter and one calling it even, that added up to a draw and an inevitable rematch next year. Joining us to discuss is Eric Raskin, co-host of the HBO Boxing Podcast and the one-time boxing writer for Grantland. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you very much, Josh.
So, Eric, in what's become de rigueur for boxing, the conversation, after even a great fight like this one, was dominated about how the sport is irredeemably corrupt and awful. The subject of said chatter this time was Adelaide Bird, the judge who saw a fight, a lopsided win for Alvarez. She saw a fight that nobody else saw. Here's what ESPN's Teddy Atlas had to say about that.
It's been years and years of the same garbage, the same trash. I have no choice. I've been in this business 40 years of life. Where am I going to go? I've got nowhere to go. But if I did, I'd get the hell out of it. I'd get the hell out of it. I'm sick and tired of watching these fighters that put everything on the line. They get in the ring, they come out of the ring with less of themselves physically than they had when they went in. and this gets done to him by a bunch of cowards at ringside that never took a punch in their life. I'm sick of it.
How does that compare to your internal monologue after the fight, Eric?
I'm a little bit less dramatic in my reaction to things than Teddy is. That's pretty standard Teddy reaction to any decision with which he does not agree. But the general sentiment I agree with. I mean, I'm a little more resigned to the attitude that boxing gonna boxing. This is the way it goes. And this fight really showcased the best and worst of boxing all at once. It demonstrated exactly why I have such admiration for boxers and why this sport can be so thrilling in ways that most sports can't, but also why it can be so frustrating. It's basically like, I love boxers. I often hate boxing. How do you screw this sport up? It should be so easy. You guys have probably heard Max Kellerman's go-to bit about how if you stop at an intersection and there's baseball being played on one corner, basketball on another, golf on the third, boxing on the fourth, obviously the crowd will gather around boxing. But the people running the sport have, for 100 years now, found ways to make a lot of people walk to a different corner. And that was really captured in Adelaide Bird's scorecard here. Not the end result. The fact that it was a draw, I didn't have an issue with. 118-110, it's just impossible to arrive at that scorecard for Canelo.
Yeah, and if you are not a boxing scorecard expert, 118-110 translates to Canelo Alvarez winning 10 rounds to 2 for Triple G. And I watched the fight. I'm not a boxing expert. And it was pretty clear to me that you have to be insane to come to that conclusion. Alvarez started pretty well and he finished pretty well, but the middle of the fight was dominated by Golovkin.
Yeah, it was in some ways, some of the rounds were not easy to score. It was tricky in spots, and it was a case of Golovkin was stalking forward the whole time, mm-hmm. and Canelo was circling, backing up, laying on the ropes in certain stretches of the fight. And there is a tendency for a lot of people to see the rounds where that happens as a Golovkin round, no matter what happens with their fists. I prefer to score based on the punching and sort of leave the idea of who's the aggressor. Make that sort of secondary. If I can't pick between who landed the better punches in a round, I'll go with the aggressor. So if you were really scoring just the punches, you know, that I ended up myself with a 114-114 scorecard from ringside and got there by, again, feeling like the punching was fairly even, although if anything in my gut, I felt like Golovkin just felt more like the winner, even though I gave them 6 rounds apiece. But again, it creates sort of these difficult rounds to score, and it comes down to some degree to just philosophy on whether a guy moving forward can take rounds. But again, when the guy is moving backwards throughout the fight, and many of the rounds are close, it's not that he's clearly out-punching Golovkin. I don't know how you find 10 rounds to give him. It just isn't possible. She gave only the 4th and 7th rounds to Golovkin when there were a couple more in there that seemed fairly clear-cut in Triple G's favor.
Also, as the Telegraph, the UK paper, pointed out, the judge who scored it a draw gave the 7th round to Canelo, which was the draw I think that everyone said Golovkin dominated the most.
Yeah, and it's interesting. That has been pointed out that if you make Dontrella's scoring of that 7th round quote-unquote correct, it turns into a split decision win for Golovkin, although then I took a closer look at his card and noticed he gave the 3rd round to Golovkin, which seemed a fairly clear-cut Canelo round, so you could flip that right back
and it won't get you anywhere.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right, so you're watching this match from ringside. I'm watching it on a YouTube video the next day before it gets taken down. We have a little bit of a different perspective here. When you're sitting that close to the ring, your assessment right after the fight was that it was a classic, that it was amazing. What are you seeing from ringside, and what made this, taking the scorecards out of it, what made this such a classic fight in your view?
I presume that you're saying that from watching it on YouTube, you didn't get the impression that you had watched a classic fight?
No, I thought it was good, but I just don't have the experience that you have. I've never sat up close at a boxing match. And I think that even if you try to tune it out, I think Stefan and I are both in the same boat here is that we're not experts, and you can get swayed by what the announcers say. You can get swayed by things other than your own two eyes. And so I'm just curious, from sitting courtside, not hearing some, you know, announcers yelling at you and telling you what to think, right, what made it such a great fight?
And I would add also that, you know, classics also depend on the environment. And being in an arena at a classic sporting event feels different than watching a classic sporting event on TV. It does influence the conclusions that you can draw.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been at a few fights like that where I was watching it live and thought I'd seen something truly special, and then found out that sort of the TV viewing experience was more like, yeah, that was pretty good. So this seems to be falling into that category, that people liked the fight, but maybe not quite as much as those of us in the arena did. It is that atmosphere of just the fans going nuts throughout. But for me, what really stood out in this fight was the tension that there was a lot on the line. If you'd followed these boxers throughout their career, you sense the stakes here. But just the tension of two guys with big punches, even though neither one clearly hurt the other at any point in this fight, as it turned out, there was a sense that either one could hurt the other with any punch at any time and end the fight or take charge of the fight, especially moments where Canelo would back to the ropes and even put his hands down and beckon Golovkin in, which is just something nobody has ever considered doing against Golovkin, a guy who at one point had 20 some odd consecutive knockouts in his favor. Those are, you know, that tension of just had me on the edge of my seat with sort of a, not only am I trying to score it and finding it to be fairly close, but there's the sense that, and this doesn't exist in other sports, that at any moment this fight could be over. Both of these guys have that power in their fists, and they're just standing there. And the clash of styles as well, I found really fascinating, with Canelo having a slight edge in hand speed, but Golovkin really cornering him and walking him down, and just watching the strategies play out.
As a non-expert, what captivated me in watching the fight was that they were fighting. I mean, it was constant. The aggression was consistent on both of their parts. There was not a lot of stalling. There was not a lot of grabbing. Though Alvarez at one point did do that arm hook and try to punch him from behind, which
right,
did see. And I also wonder whether there isn't a little recency bias here. Because of the Mayweather-McGregor fight just a few weeks ago, which was roundly derided as a spectacle, and the fight itself was no great shakes to watch, to say the least, are we influenced by that? By the fact that, oh, as one of the announcers actually said during the Canelo Triple G fight in the 12th round, this is real boxing, this is a real fight, which I couldn't help but think was a direct subtweet of McGregor Mayweather.
I'm sure it was. I haven't heard the commentary back, but McGregor and Mayweather was on a different network, and on HBO, I know that the attitude has very much been not to say favorable things about that fight, and so I wouldn't be at all surprised if that was Jim Lampley or someone like that who said it, if he was taking a fairly clear shot at Mayweather-McGregor. And certainly, yeah, in comparison to that fight, which actually exceeded my incredibly low expectations. It wasn't the terrible fight that I expected, but it was nothing you want to necessarily watch a second time. This certainly looks thrilling compared to that. I think also, if we're grading on some sort of a curve with Triple G and Canelo, it's that we're grading it against other recent mega fights, which have rarely been fight of the year type fights. It seems like it's been a long time. You know, back in the 80s, you look back and Leonard Hearns, Hagler all lived up to the billing and turned out to be classics. More recently, a lot of these fights, partially because Floyd Mayweather was at the center of them and doesn't have a thrilling style and often wins his fights in lopsided fashion, very few of the huge fights have turned out to be great fights. You know, occasionally there's an exception. The fourth Pacquiao-Marquez fight is probably the last huge pay-per-view super fight that turned out to be fight of the year caliber. But, you know, that was 5 years ago, I think, 6 years ago. So just in that regard, Canelo Triple G living up to, and I would say even exceeding our expectations for being a competitive action fight, I think maybe that leads me and some others to perhaps slightly overemphasize just how good it was.
I want to dig in a little bit more to that bad scorecard. Oscar De La Hoya, who was Alvarez's promoter and whose fighter benefited from that scorecard, said, "What was that? People are scratching their heads. I'm shocked by that score." And it's telling that he felt the need to say, "I can assure you there's no influence whatsoever on which judges are selected." What is your theory about what happened there? Do you think that, as you said before, it's just that it was a hard fight to score?
And that's what she saw?
Or do you think that it's suspicious enough that Adelaide Bird should never, judge a fight again? Do you think there should be some sort of official inquiry? Like, where's your head at there?
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily view it as suspicious, but I still come to the conclusion that Adelaide Bird should never judge a major fight again, or at least should be demoted for a long time while she works her way back up and proves her capabilities. The reason that I'm not so suspicious of it is it seems logical to me that if the fix was going to be in, if you were determined to make sure that Canelo won no matter what, you wouldn't make it 118, 110. There are ways to be less obvious in terms of who you're favoring. So that's what sort of throws me off.
That's
the
just what they want you to think, Eric.
Exactly.
It's a reverse double
right.
cross.
Right. Adelaide Bird is a step ahead of me and my analysis. If she had handed in a card of 115, 113, or maybe even 116, 112 for Canelo, I don't think that there would be the uproar. To me, it's just a case of you could say she had a bad night, except that she has had enough bad nights before that there were warnings before the fight. Some writers were pointing out not liking seeing her assigned to this fight. I personally have, watched boxing with fellow writers and on the TV, they flash who the judges are and Adelaide Bird's name comes up and everyone groans because we know that she has a tendency to give you wacky scorecards. There was even an incident last year where she was assigned to a fight and Top Rank, the promoter, lobbied the commission to take her off the fight. They were so suspicious of what kind of a scorecard she might hand in. So with all of that in mind, I would love to see the commission give her an intense inquiry and have her either disappear for a short while or a long while. And that's happened. There was a judge just recently, CJ Ross, scored Tim Bradley, the extremely controversial winner over Manny Pacquiao in their first fight. They gave CJ Ross another chance, and she had the Mayweather-Canelo fight, 114-114, a draw when almost everyone thought Mayweather won 11 or 12 of the 12 rounds. So, and after that second incident, she hasn't judged a fight since. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's the road we go down here with Adelaide Bird, who just, it's too many scorecards that make no sense to just let it slide.
All right, let's get even bigger picture here. Forget Adelaide Bird. What is your view on whether just the entire way that boxing is judged makes sense? Because this is not an issue of like one judge making, one bad scoring decision. You mentioned in a thing that you wrote for HBO about Leonard and Hagler,
in 1987,
decades ago, having a similarly egregious scorecard. Does scoring a fight, with 10-9 scoring each round, does that make sense? Should it be judged more using like CompuBox stats? Like, if fuck ups keep happening, why do we keep doing the exact same thing every time?
Yeah, it's been a problem that has been a part of boxing for much longer than I've been around, and it never seems to get better. After this fight in particular, I found myself wondering. There was a hundred years ago, they basically used the system that in many fights, especially non-title fights, if there wasn't a knockout, then there was no winner. And a lot of fights are in the record books as having a quote unquote newspaper decision, which means that it would just be based the history would remember the winner based on who the newspaper reporters at ringside covering it favored.
They're in there with the shruggy emoticon.
that would have been the correct emoticon to use had emoticons been around in the day. But yeah, the problem with, of course, using newspaper decisions is many of the newspaper writers were on the take back then. So that wouldn't get you very far either. But there is like a sense of, can we just have them fight? And if nobody knocks anybody out, then there's no winner. But well, obviously
that
wouldn't be satisfying to anyone. Right. Exactly. Well, that's not the solution that anyone wants.
But the thing that I found interesting was that you said you scored it 6-6, but you thought that Golovkin probably won. Like, would you, if you were like liberated from having that round by round system, that's what you would have said after the fight, as you say, I declare Golovkin the winner of this fight?
Yeah. I mean, I still think the round by round system makes sense, but I would love to see everyone judges encouraged to make more liberal use of those points. You almost never see anyone given a round other than 10-9 unless there's a knockdown. So it's almost like, why are we doing this 10-point must system? Couldn't it just be 1-0? I'd love to see a situation where if a guy wins a round so close that you have a hard time deciding, you make it 10-9. If he wins it clearly, you make it 10-8. If he wins it in absolutely dominant fashion, even without a knockdown, maybe you can go 10-7 and then add, subtract additional points for a knockdown. I'd love to see something like that so that you can have a case like this where maybe you scored it 6-6, but you felt Golovkin won some of his rounds more clearly.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Your scorecard in the end might reflect that. But for whatever reason, the commissions have never acted on that. Maybe just out of a fear that it's an easier system to corrupt. I guess that
Adelaide Bird would have had the fight 118 to like 40.
right. It starts to sound like one of those scores from the old Da Bears skits where they're picking the Bears to win 62-3. The scores would get even more out of whack, I guess, if you use that. But I think it also, as long as the judges are all doing a good job and being honest, you could get better reflections of the fight you've just seen.
The draw does ensure the possibility of a rematch here, which with fair judging and similar participation and enthusiasm by the boxers could mean a great rematch.
Yeah, I'm almost certain that it will happen, even though Canelo seems somewhat noncommittal in his post-fight interview, which is somewhat understandable, just with the idea in the back of his mind of, do I really want to go through another 12 rounds of that? I suspect he'll come around, that both his pride and the money to be made will encourage him to make it happen. They're already talking about Cinco de Mayo weekend next year, making the most sense. I guess the thing is that you didn't need a draw to make a rematch logical and a near certainty. Take Adelaide Bird's scorecard and make it 115-113 for Golovkin so that Golovkin actually gets the majority decision win, there would be every bit as much demand for a rematch.
Because it was a good fight.
It was a good fight and a close fight no matter how you scored it. So a rematch would make perfect sense regardless of the fact that it ended up a draw or a potential or a close win one way or the other.
Eric Raskin is the co-host of the HBO Boxing Podcast. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Eric.
My pleasure, guys.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Given my not-so-outrageous athletic ability, I've always had a sense that I was probably not the world's greatest Josh when it comes to running or jumping or doing much of anything else that involves the human body. There are surely better Levines out there, too, because it's not the most uncommon surname. But it wasn't until American Ninja Warrior that I found out that I'm not even the greatest Josh Levine or Levin, of all time. Let's take a listen to my namesake as he competed in stage one of Ninja Warrior's Las Vegas National Finals, which were broadcast on NBC earlier this month.
Gotta be careful here on the double dipper. It's already taken out some good ones.
Right, here we go. Josh Levin, he's got to let it flow, let it go right there. Nice transition.
Boy, the good ones make it look so easy.
On the transition, especially. Yes. All the ones who've succeeded here tonight.
But now another tough one, the jumping spider. And look at him run. Just gets it locked in on the jumping spider. And he's only 5'6", but having no problem working through this chute.
No problem working through that shoot. Josh finished that stage and will be competing in the season finale of American Ninja Warrior on NBC on Monday night, September 18th at 8 p.m. Eastern. Josh is joining us now from a McDonald's in Stuttgart, Germany, where he is eating a Happy Meal and competing in a rock climbing competition in Stuttgart. Welcome to Hang Up and Listen, Josh.
Thanks so much, Josh. It's an honor to be here.
Stefan, how do you feel about this moment?
I feel confused to have two Josh Levins on the show. I'm just going to call you guys Josh so I don't have to worry about the last name thing.
That works for me. So, Josh, we've got a bit of a Schrodinger's Ninja situation. By the time most of our listeners hear this episode, the finale will have aired, and it could be revealed that you're $1 million richer, or maybe you fell in a pit somewhere, and you're just, like, fishing yourself out. You obviously know what happened, but you're not able to say due to non-disclosure agreement. So first, congratulations or condolences. And second, is it hard for you to compete in something like this and not be able to share what happened?
Yeah, I think the nature of competing on a reality television show, especially a game show like American Ninja Warrior, is that it's filmed way in advance, like several months in advance. And then when it airs on TV, you can't tell your friends or anyone that hasn't been to the filming itself what's happened before it actually airs on TV. So there's this huge amount of heightened suspense, and there's like a fact that you know how well you did, but you can't say. And yeah, there's always a sense of a big reveal when the show actually airs on TV. So it's always exciting to be able to share that with friends and family.
In researching your climbing history, Josh, I was intrigued by a few things. One, you started speed climbing, indoor racing, when you were really young. There's a little bio of you that is wildly entertaining that people can check out on YouTube. And then you discovered Ninja, and in that bio you say that you've been training for this since you were 15, but Ninja Warrior doesn't let you compete until you're 21. Why this? Sort of how did you come to not just the speed climbing, but then the desire to become a Ninja Warrior? And then we can talk about sort of how this has become so popular in the last few years.
Climbing is very instinctual for me. When I was super young, I would climb out of my crib and on tables and counters. And my parents can tell you plenty of stories about how whenever they can't find me, they always end up looking up. So from a very young age, climbing was just this natural instinctual thing that I was always, I don't want to say born to do, but it was something that I naturally was inclined to be drawn towards. And I think that's true for a lot of kids. I mean, the way we can explain how climbing has evolved in the last several decades is, I mean, if you break down human movement into four categories, the most basic movements any kids will want to do is run, swim, jump, or climb. And it just so happens that I love to climb. Some kids love to swim, some kids love to run or jump, and I just love climbing. That's just something I am naturally drawn to. The great thing about indoor rock climbing is how I got my start in athletics, is that it's becoming much more accessible in the United States, especially in the last several years. So when I was about 4 or 5 years old, I found my very first ever indoor rock climbing gym in Northern California. And it was just happened to be the case that there was one close by to where I lived. It was a pretty cheap rate. And the coaching staff were really friendly and helpful and supportive to be able to make me transition from, you know, this rambunctious little kid into someone who is really passionate about the sport of rock climbing.
One of the things that NBC has done a really good job of is making the competitors into characters or into people that a mass audience really wants to follow and root for. There are people like Jessie Graff, who was the first woman to, you know, get past a particular stage, Casey Catanzaro before her, Isaac Caldero, Jeff Britton, and you've become one of those people, Josh. How do you feel about how do you feel about how NBC kind of creates characters on the show and how you've been portrayed?
Yeah, sure. I think the whole idea of it being this big TV show and having to create these characters, something that they've really tried. It's a tested and true strategy that they've done with the Olympics, with, you know, not necessarily everyone's going to know about each and every single sport that they wouldn't see normally on TV. But if you talk about, you know, for example, like luge or I don't know, some martial art that no one is really watching on a day-to-day basis, people aren't going to be really invested in the sport itself until you give them a story and a personality and a character to really get behind it and really come to terms with. And so I think the thing, the big draw of American Ninja Warrior for most people is that they see people who they can really relate to in a very fundamental level in all facets of the show. So no matter who you are, like, you know, how old you are, how young you are, what kind of, if you're black, you're white, you know, whatever kind of background you come from, there is someone in American Ninja Warrior that represents you. And you can feel represented no matter what kind of background you come from, which right. I think is really incredible. And I think that's probably one of the biggest draws is that the emotional connection that you create with these characters that you see on TV doing these obstacles. I mean, it wouldn't be the same without having these incredible backstories of people overcoming obstacles both on and off the course.
And it's not just the best athletes either. NBC does do a good job of also including people who go out in early rounds, who come from background, who are not like 19-time world champions in a particular sport.
Absolutely.
You mentioned a couple of things that got me wondering. One is that there's this group of characters that are very familiar to people as athletes. And the second is that Ninja Warrior spread all over the world. And typically when you put those two things together, it leads to the ultimate question of, is this going to be an Olympic sport in some form? And Ninja Warrior now does a team competition, national team competitions, and we saw you there. And the kind of exposure that NBC has given, and that clip we heard that we played at the top of the segment, that was Mike Tirico being part of the play-by-play team. so it is. I mean, is that something you guys are talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it would be really incredible to have Ninja Warrior as an Olympic sport. Of course, there's a lot of hurdles we have to get over first. And having gone through the whole process with climbing, I mean, in 2013, we applied to become an Olympic sport for the very first time, and it actually got rejected at first. And so we had to kind of go back to the drawing board and figure out all these different ways of incorporating different elements of climbing and promoting it on a national, international level, I should say. But there's also a fair amount of check marks you're required to have as well. So you have to have international federation. You have to have a certain number of national federations that are a part of that. And of course, you have to have a certain level of world championships, both at the professional level and at the youth level as well, I believe.
So you frequently take off your shirt on in the competition. Is that for athletic reasons or just to show off your awesome bod?
I guess by admitting this, I'd have to admit a little bit of micro strategy. Is that part of the TV show is what you see on TV is like all the lights and camera in action and, you know, that you have the announcers. But there's a lot of things that you don't really know about that happen when the show is being filmed. One of them, for example, during the city rounds, so not the Vegas finals, which are being aired right now, but during the city rounds, which have aired over the last couple months, you're actually only allowed to take 30 seconds rest in between obstacles. And the producers are like, can be pretty strict on it, depending on the person running. But the strategy that I've kind of developed, and of course, this is kind of giving away one of my secrets, is that if you do something dramatic or engage the crowd in some way, you're generally allowed a little bit more time to rest before you go to the next obstacle. So part of my strategy, of course, now is, okay, well, I think I've been about 30 seconds. So at that point, you can kind of play to the crowd or this case, like take your shirt off and you'll generally get a little bit more time to shake out your arms, get a little blood flow going before
That's
we
awesome.
Try the next obstacle.
I love that. What is what is the most challenging obstacle for you? You're somebody who has tremendous upper body strength from all of your climbing experience. Does that make the ones that are more focused on like lower body or agility more challenging
and
for
you? You're also only 5'6" and you weigh 150. But the warped wall, you know, doesn't seem to give you too much trouble.
The warped wall is definitely a much more technique oriented obstacle. Like, it may look really intimidating, but I guarantee you, like, if I had some time to practice with you guys and give you some really good tips and get you just the right shoes to try it, because shoes are actually really important, you guys could get up the warp wall. I will guarantee that.
Stefan has problems with his ACLs.
That's all right.
Okay. We'll give you a spot. Yeah.
And Josh is not 5'6". So if we could get you in the same room, it would be an excellent photo.
Perfect. Yeah. Anyway, so I think the question being which one is the most difficult for me. As a climber, I definitely, on the surface have like a much more, much better ability to do the upper body oriented obstacles. But the biggest thing that I had to learn transitioning from a sport like climbing to a sport like Ninja Warrior is that in rock climbing, whether you're doing competitions or climbing outdoors, everything is very static and fixed, and you're just moving your body in between these fixed positions. Mm-hmm. And so with Ninja Warrior, you have to really think about exactly how each of these obstacles is going to move, and it's much more dynamic because the thing you're jumping to with your hands or the thing you're running across with your feet isn't going to stay still. So that's a much more tricky scenario to try and interpret and understand how it's going to interact with you and your body movement. So I think a lot of the lower body obstacles, as difficult as they may be for some climbers, like as long as you practice the movements, it's not, those aren't necessarily the hardest obstacles. And the upper body ones too, like there's some that are really tricky, but as a climber, the ones that are much more finger and upper body dependent, those are generally like easier coming from a background like climbing.
Right. There was an interesting piece on Deadspin by Devorah Myers last week about whether Ninja Warrior can save men's gymnastics. Mm. You know, women's gymnastics gets that quadrennial bump from the Olympics. Sure. These women become stars. They become, you know, marketable. On the men's side, that doesn't typically happen. You're not a gymnast, but at the same time, it does seem clear that if these ninja gyms are getting built all over the place, there has to be a spillover effect, both in helping to train young athletes who want to become ninja warriors and compete, and vice versa, taking kids out of the ninja gym and getting them into gymnastics gyms where they can, you know, get a college scholarship.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely true. And I did go ahead and look at the article. And of course, I'm not familiar as much with gymnastics as I am with Ninja Warrior climbing. But I could definitely appreciate that. I think that the idea of the fact that there's such a gender divide in the United States specifically about gymnastics is pretty interesting subject. And especially that Ninja Warrior seems to be this big catalyst for boys specifically to get involved in this sort of athletic endeavor. I think for me, it's a little hard to wrap my mind around that because at least in competitive climbing, the gender ratio is much more even. In our organization, USA Climbing, we actually have an almost perfectly even divide. I think it's 51% male competitors and 49% female competitors, which is pretty incredible for any sport, let alone the one I'm involved in. And in Ninja Warrior, it definitely, at least the TV show, encourages participation of men and women. And I think the whole idea that men and women can compete on the same course is a pretty a groundbreaking concept and something that you don't really see in gymnastics a lot because they have different apparatuses.
All right, Josh, all of us Josh Levines are very, very proud of you. All of the ones whose Gmail that I get by mistake, we talk about you all the time.
I'm making T-shirts that say Team Josh, and I can decide later who I'm rooting for.
Awesome.
But we'll be watching you on Ninja Warrior. You're going to be trying to make the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo, which is super exciting. So,
not a Ninja Warrior.
Not a Ninja Warrior, but in climbing.
Not yet.
So good luck with everything, and thanks so much for coming on the show.
Great. Thanks so much, Josh. It's been fun. Great having you.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now it is time for After Balls. And Josh, I think we should honor Josh by naming After Balls this week.
Shall we scale to the vertiginous heights of Mount Midoriyama?
No, that would be too obvious. I think we should pick a different obstacle. And the taxonomy of American Ninja Warrior obstacles is interesting. Some are very bland. You know, you got your unstable bridge.
What about the stable bridge? It's a little better than that.
True. Lamp grasper. It really doesn't flow off the tongue, the lamp grasper. I like Domino Hill. I like Rumbling Dice. I like the Monkey Peg, Cannonball Alley, Tarzan Rope. Pretty explicit.
Did you say Cannibal Alley?
Cannibal Alley would be an excellent obstacle.
Next season, NBC.
Yes.
Do it up.
Instead of water, cannibals, if you fall.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think your top three, final three candidates, your Warped Wall, because it's a classic, and with Josh's training advice, you and I could scale it, and your Salmon Ladder. That's the one where you got to hold on the bar and
you got to spawn upstream.
But I really like the Jumping Spider.
Why do you like it, Stephen?
I like the name. I like the idea of a spider jumping. Spiders really aren't very good jumpers. And it's that cool plexiglass thing, and you have to use your hands and your feet.
Your eight limbs.
Yes. And if we tried to do it, it would be called the tearing groin.
I like Jumping Spider better. Let's stick with that. Stephen, what is your Jumping Spider?
The Cleveland Indians' crazy winning streak stopped the other day at an American League record 22 games, short of the Major League record of 26, belonging to the 1916 New York Giants. That one had a plot twist. 12 games into the streak, the Giants tied a game. Now, I was curious about the tie game, so where did I go? I went to retrosheet.org, of course. There you will see that the tie game was called after 8 innings, that Paul Parrott pitched for the Giants, Hall of Famer Burley Grimes pitched for the Pirates, and that the game lasted an hour and 24 minutes. What you will not see, though, is a play-by-play account of the game. Collecting the play-by-play accounts of every Major League game played since 1901 has been RetroSheet's goal since it was started in 1989 by a University of Delaware biology professor and Society for American Baseball Research member named David Smith. I wrote a story about RetroSheet for the Wall Street Journal way back in 2002. At the time, Dave and a handful of researchers had compiled play-by-play accounts for about 70,000 of the 115,000 Major League games played between 1901 and 1983, after which complete records have been kept. That left about 45,000 games unaccounted for. 15 years later, I am here to report that RetroSheet has whittled the number of missing games down to about 16,000, which is pretty amazing. That's about 8% of all Major League Baseball games between 1901 and 2016 are unaccounted for at this point. The last push to completion, though, won't be easy. Dave told me over the weekend that RetroSheet has exhausted the conventional sources for scorecards like team archives, baseball writers, the Hall of Fame. The Hall of Fame yielded about 30,000 games, he said. But RetroSheet isn't giving up. It is now forensically recreating play-by-play by combing through newspaper accounts of games. RetroSheet is calling these deduced games. Dave says the approach has been surprisingly effective. There are usually multiple accounts from every game. The stories usually cover all runs scored and all unusual plays. Things that aren't deducible, like the fielders on most outs, are noted as such in the record. Dave says a group of 5 volunteers is knocking out about 3 to 4 games a day. So far, they've added around 2,000 deduced games, which completes the baseball record back through 1942. They are currently working on July 1941. I asked one of the RetroSheet researchers, Tom Thress, to walk me through one of those games. He chose the White Sox beating the Red Sox 10-4 at Fenway Park on July 23rd, 1941. 6 newspapers covered the game, 2 Chicago, 3 Boston, and the New York Times. The Chicago papers contained play-by-play for the first 2 innings and the top of the 4th through the top of the 7th, so Tom had to deduce what happened in the 3rd inning and in the last 2.5 innings. Of those 7 half innings, runs were scored in 3. Those were reported in full by the newspapers. That left him 2 half innings with the Red Sox batting, the 8th and 9th, and 3 for the White Sox, the 3rd, 7th, and 9th. The Red Sox were easy. They only got 1 runner on base And from the box score, Thress figured out that it was a single by Jimmy Fox in the ninth. Because they're all bounded by what he called known innings, Thress knew that the White Sox had four batters in all three of their unknown innings. The ninth was covered in a note in the Boston Globe because there was a weird play in which Taft Wright had a home run called foul, although several soldiers in that sector indicated it was fair, which was the way it looked from the press box. The story reported that Wright then singled, but that Red Sox center fielder Dom DiMaggio's peg was able to rub out Luke Appling at home to end the game. So again, looking at the box score, Thress could tell that Appling was missing a single and a stolen base, so he filled in the blanks. Appling had singled, stole second, and was thrown out by DiMaggio. That left two White Sox half innings and two missing base runners. Because the four batters in the third inning were different from the four in the seventh inning, by cross-referencing the box score, Thress was able to deduce that Miral Hoge had singled in the third and Bill Knickerbocker had walked in the seventh. Et voila, Thress wrote to me in an email, a full account of the game. When I wrote my piece for the Journal, I quoted baseball historian Paul Dixon, who uttered one of my favorite quotes. He said that rebuilding baseball's past the way RetroSheet was doing might seem like trying to recreate a puff of cigar smoke from William Howard Taft's mouth. It's so ephemeral. William Howard Taft. Love William Howard Taft. But that is what makes baseball so great, Dixon said. The past counts, and no one has made the past count more than RetroSheet. 16,000 games to go. I have no doubt that someday they will all be accounted for.
Are they accepting volunteerism from the masses? Because I feel like this was something, if technology had been what it is now, that when I was a kid who was like A, super obsessed with baseball, and B, really into like logic problems and puzzles, I would have gotten really into this.
Oh, RetroSheet is totally happy to have people contribute. I mean, they've had people find scorecards in their attic that have filled in the blanks. And I'm sure they would welcome contributions from baseball historians and amateur baseball sleuths. That's how Sabre has functioned since its inception. It's just people who love the game. Josh, what's your jumping spider?
You might have seen last week that Florida Atlantic University and its head coach Lane Kiffin took out a full-page ad in the Wisconsin State Journal to thank the University of Wisconsin for the hospitality it had shown the FAU football team after Hurricane Irma. Every single person on campus in the community was kind and courteous. The Badger football team even shared their home with us and made our stay as comfortable as possible.
Oh, Lane Kiffin's such a nice guy.
You might have also seen that Kevin Durant took out a full-page ad in the San Francisco Chronicle to thank Golden State fans for making my initial season with the Warriors an incredible and exhilarating championship experience, and that Yu Darvish took out a full-page ad in the Dallas Morning News to thank Ranger fans after being traded to L.A. The Rangers took out a full-page ad in Japan's daily newspaper Yomiuri Shimbun to thank Yu Darvish for his dedication to hard work and many accomplishments. Given the decline in classifieds, our leading papers would surely no longer be in business if players and coaches and teams did not make the ultimate classy gesture of taking out a full-page ad, and it has to be a full page. Nobody ever notes that a team or an athlete took out a half-page ad or a quarter-page ad or, God forbid, an ad of an even smaller fractional amount. We know that the full-page sports thank you ad is a thing, but I wanted to know where it came from and when it started, so I searched newspapers.com for the phrase, took out a full-page ad, and I have come back to report on what I found. The first reference, Stefan, was that in 1952, Macy's took out a full-page ad to applaud what it called the most important thing that has happened to the movie since they started to talk. That, of course, was Cinerama, a system whereby three synchronized projectors displayed a movie on a massive curved screen. That is Cinerama.
Macy's was appreciative of Cinerama?
Cinerama. Who among us was not appreciative of Cinerama? Indeed, the full-page ad was a movie thing. Producers taking out full-page ads in Variety to stump for their films and whatnot. The second reference to the term I found comes from 1955 United Press story that notes the producer Stanley Kramer once took out a full-page ad to deny that one of his employees, Robert Mitchum, had been late to work. Good fodder for Stefan's full-page ad. In 1968, the Beatles reportedly took out a full-page ad in the London Times that argued for the legalization of marijuana. good full page ad fodder. But what of sports, you ask? Some of my favorite took out a full page ad references from the early days of the took out a full page ad era include an April 5th, 1968 column in the Minneapolis Star notes that the Kentucky Colonels of the NBA took out a full page ad in a Louisville paper in their efforts to sign Wesley Unseld. An excerpt from that ad: the Colonels urge all basketball fans in Kentucky to tell Wesley by wire or by phone that they want him to play in Kentucky, the ad said. I don't think that he ever played in Kentucky. Don't think it worked. The next reference that I found, which is quite a good one, the Haiti game, November 1968, that was between the Raiders and the Jets, famous game in which NBC broke away from its broadcast on the East Coast. Close game to show the TV movie Haiti. The Raiders' comeback was missed by those fans who got to see Heidi instead. NBC took out a full-page ad in New York newspaper, quoting nine television critics on the showing of Heidi rather than the Jets-Raiders game. One of those critics was Joe Namath, the Jets quarterback, who said, "I didn't get a chance to see it," in reference to Heidi, "but I hear it was great." Ira Berkow, 1973, he was then writing for the Newspaper Enterprise Association, wrote that Cubs owner Philip Wrigley took out a full-page ad in Chicago to, and this is Berkow writing, condemn a dump DeRocher click. That's in reference to Cubs manager Leo DeRocher. The full-page ad was headlined, "This is for Cub fans and anyone else who is interested." The ad concluded, "Leo is running the team, and if some of the players do not like it and lie down on the job during the offseason, we will see what we can do to find them happier homes." Signed, Phil Wrigley. DeRocher was fired the next season. My favorite of these full-page ads, though, came in the Albuquerque Journal in New Mexico, November 10th, 1967. I'm going to turn around my computer to show you, Stefan. You've got "Support the Lobos" at the top with an exclamation point. "Now is when they need your support. Tomorrow," you've got a picture of a kind of old-timey football guy. Coach Bill Weeks' Lobos meet 7th-ranked Wyoming, 12.05 p.m. An upset could be in the making for Lobo fans and the regional television fans in 12 Western states. It ends at the bottom with, "The Lobos haven't quit!" Exclamation point. "Don't quit on them!" Exclamation point, exclamation point. Also, "Enjoy the great halftime entertainment," featuring the UNM and Wyoming band. So let's look at how this...
There's a backstory there.
Let's look at how this went played out. Yeah, they got off to a good start that year, beat Idaho State 24-3. And let's see how Lobos did. L, that's not good. L, followed by L, then L, Texo Paso by 75-12. Not the best L that I've ever seen. L to Arizona, 48-13. So not really... You can understand why the fans might have needed to be urged to attend this Lobos game. Saturday, November 11th, 1967, against Wyoming. Home game, Albuquerque, New Mexico, L, 6-42. But
what was the attendance?
Not sure what the attendance was, but I can report this. Look what the Albuquerque Journal wrote a few days later. You've got a photo in the sports section. The caption is, "Faithful fans, Mr. and Mrs. Chris Parks seated were guests of the New Mexico football team at their training meal prior to last Saturday's game with Wyoming. Mrs. Sparks revealed herself as the mystery fan who took out a full-page ad in last Friday's journal urging other fans to support the team. The Sparks, with the Sparks, are co-captains Rex Hennington and Dennis Marr. The Lobos repaid the kindness of Mrs. Sparks by getting their asses kicked against Wyoming.
They got a good meal out of it, though.
That is our show for today. Our producer is Patrick Fort. To listen to past shows and to subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. For Stefan Fatsis, I'm Josh Levine. Remember Zelmo Beatty. And thanks for listening.